My name is Kat, and I'm an alcoholic. Yes. Welcome to the Monday night Blue Chip Speakers meeting at the NABA Club, where a member of Alcoholics Anonymous with 1 year or more of sobriety tells his or her story. This reading is based on a passage from page 29 of the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. Each individual in our personal stories describes in their own language and from their own point of view the way they establish their relationship with God. These give a fair cross-section of our membership and a clear-cut idea of what has happened in their lives. We hope no one will consider these self-revealing accounts in bad taste. Our hope is that many alcoholic men and women in our room tonight and later listening on abluechipspeakers.org desperately in need will hear our speaker, and we believe that it is only by fully disclosing ourselves and our problems that any of us shall be persuaded to say, yes, I am one of them too. I must have this thing. Tonight I get to introduce the speaker, Carrie. I have known her since almost day one. She's always been very sweet and taught me a lot. She doesn't realize it, but she did. I will give you Carrie. Yay.
They had to bring in a step for me so they could see me. That's funny. Hey everybody, my name is Carrie and I'm an alcoholic. And I'm really happy to be here today. I'm really honored to be asked to do this. And I'm a little nervous. So I want to start with a joke. Not really. I just want to see what the interpreter would do. So you've noticed we've had some people up here signing in American Sign Language. That's because I'm a member of the Deaf Sober group, and I've been a member of that home group for over 20 years. And I've invited some of the members to be here and participate in the meeting, and I'm really so glad that they could do so. And really glad that we have interpreters here to help. As I was reading my daily reflection today, it struck me that this is why we tell our story. It's called lightening the burden. Showing others who suffer how we were given help is the very thing which makes life seem so worthwhile to us now. The dark past is the key to life and happiness for others. And that's from the Big Book, page 124. So my sobriety date is October 3rd, 1994. I got sober in my 20s. I was 28. You can do the math. I always do that when someone stands up here. So I'm 51 years old, and I'm proud of that. I'm proud I made it this far for many reasons, but most importantly because I found AA. So my home group, as I mentioned, is the NABA Deaf Sober group. We meet every Sunday afternoon at 4 o'clock right here at NABA Club in that small room. We have sign language interpreters, so everyone is welcome. Come and share your experience, strength, and hope. If you want to have a different kind of meeting, we're it. So I want to tell a little bit about what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now. So I was born in Kansas City, Missouri, and my parents are from Illinois, so I'm a Midwesterner at heart. In fact, I was just up in Illinois this last week. I love it up there. My mother's family were farmers for many generations until recently. When I say recently, I mean my grandparents and my parents. On my dad's side, they were coal miners. And then my mom and actually her father and his siblings went into education. So I come from a line of educators. So education was very important in my family. It was expected that I would go to school and I would do well. And as I got into my drinking, that didn't always happen. When I was pretty young, we moved to Miami. So I grew up in Miami in the 80s, which was interesting. If you've ever seen the TV show Miami Vice, it was pretty much like that. I mean, even though I lived in the suburbs, everything was available. I think that was just before the crack epidemic really started. I know people were smoking crack, but it wasn't really around where I was growing up. So I feel fortunate that I didn't get exposed to that at that time, because who knows, I might not be standing here. I really can't remember my first drink. There was always booze around my house. My father was a heavy drinker, is a heavy drinker, he's still alive. Both my parents are still alive. I'm very blessed in that way. I think what happened was one day I came in when I was a kid and I'd been playing outside and it was hot, and I grabbed a pitcher of what I thought was water, and it was not water, it was martinis, and I kind of gagged a little bit, but I didn't really, you know, start drinking a lot after that. My family was pretty normal. You know, they worked, they had jobs, we went to church. But when I turned about 14 or 15, I started getting involved with drinking and, you know, experimenting with drugs. That's not a big part of my story. It was the alcohol that really took me down. Started smoking cigarettes and hanging out with the rough crowd. I always enjoyed hanging out with, well, the bad boys. And my father worked for Department of Corrections, so he would always look them up. He was for the NCIC. I'm like, you're going to find something. So anyway. It was a lot of fun growing up in Miami at that time. It was just, you could go to the beach, you could hang out. A lot of parties. And I got involved with the German club because I thought that I would study German and learn German as a second language, because there were so many people that spoke Spanish. I thought, I'll never be as good as they are, so I'm going to take up a different language. So I studied German. And my dad had been in the service and he'd been in Germany, so there was kind of that culture around the house, and the Biersteins and the Lederhosen and all that German stuff. So, but being involved with German and the German club, we drank a lot because German culture involves beer. So back then the drinking age was, it was like 18. And then I was grandfathered in and eventually became 21, I think, by the time I got to college. But I was kind of lucky at that time because I could always buy beer. And I probably looked about 12, but because the drinking age was 18, you know, they didn't really care. And so that was a lot of fun. I was a blackout drinker for the most part. I would, you know, just drink and mix other stuff. Well, I don't know, Quaaludes were big back then. Anybody heard of Quaaludes? So that was a long time ago. And, you know, so that would pretty much erase, you know, any memory that I had. So that was not good. And I mentioned this only because, you know, as women, we do tend to put ourselves in situations, you know, to dangerous situations. And I think when I came into AA, I had very low self-esteem. And I'll get into that. I got ahead of myself a little bit. So drinking was fun. I always thought it was kind of funny when people would call me the next day and say, can you believe what you did? I can't believe you said that, or you got thrown in the swimming pool again, because I was always about 95 pounds. I was really small, and they would throw me in the swimming pool, and I hated that. I would fight, but they would still throw me in. So I got through high school. My grades started to suffer, and I picked them back up again enough to get into college, and I came to college up here in Atlanta. At first, I went to a junior college, and it was a small school. Now, the high school I went to in Miami was like, I think we had 700 people in my graduating class, which was huge. And I went to this small two-year college, which only had 500 people at the whole place. So it was a little different for me. I would drink. I mean, we could drink on campus, I guess. Then they banned it later. But I found that there was a group of mainly guys, because I would drink like as hard as the guys would. And some of the girls were like, ooh, you know. But then I did find a girl who was a party animal, and we ended up, actually she was my roommate. And so that worked out pretty well. You know, drinking was fun up to a point. I started drinking when I was about 15, I guess. And it's all fun and games until, you know, you end up in a strange place with vomit all over you and having to walk back to your dorm room. And hasn't that happened to everybody? I don't know. I just thought it was normal. So that's when I kind of, looking back, as I was preparing my story, I'm looking back and I'm thinking, there were some signs along the way that, you know, that was not normal drinking behavior. Getting in some of the situations. I got in a situation where I was a clumsy drunk too. I would fall down. I fell down a lot and I hurt myself. And I fell down and I hit my head and I was bleeding all over, and they took me to the hospital, and then I had no memory of that. So it came really close to my eye. I mean, I could have lost my eye. So just stuff like that. Just stupid stuff from drinking. And then when I went, I finished that 2-year school and went to the main campus of that school, and I got involved with living in the international dorm, and that was really fun for me because I always enjoyed learning about different languages and culture. I grew up in Miami. We had really 3 languages there. There was a lot of people spoke Spanish there, a lot of Haitian people spoke French, Creole. So I always was interested in learning different languages and about different cultures. So I moved into this international dorm, and we would have parties. We were supposed to have educational presentations, but it wasn't always in the spirit of educating. So some friends of mine and I decided we would throw a German Indian night. We called it German Indian, and all I remember is like it involved a keg and some curry dishes, and it was just really an excuse to drink. And it kind of went along like that for a while. And then my last year of college, I was down in South Florida again and met this person who I called a man from hell. And I got involved with, it was an abusive relationship. And I was physically abused for about 3 years in that relationship. And I drank a lot to cover that up and to kind of deny what was going on. But there were times when I thought I would die. The night that I finally left, I really thought I was going to die. So that's one reason why I'm glad I'm, you know, here, that I'm standing here. So I did get away. I escaped. I went back to my parents' house, and you know, that was shameful. But I kept on drinking, and I moved back up to Atlanta because I felt like I needed to leave the state. And I moved in with some people that I knew, and I slept on their couch. And that worked out for a while. Then I moved in with some roommates, and that was a good situation. And then I decided I don't like roommates anymore, and I moved into a little tiny attic apartment, and that's when I experienced the end of my drinking. And I was isolated, and I was working night shift. And I would work until like 2 or 3 in the morning, and then come home and drink until it got light outside, and then sleep all day. And who knew that the Munsters would play at 2 a.m. or 3 a.m. every day. I'd watch the Munsters and all these reruns on TV. And I would think about all the things I was going to do with my life. I was going to stop drinking. I was going to get a better job. I was going to get a better relationship with my family. I was going to find a better man. I was going to do whatever. And basically that's when I hit my bottom. It was an emotional bottom. There's times when I hit physical bottom, but I was just too stubborn or hard-headed to stop. But in that little attic apartment by myself, it was pretty miserable. And so I was lucky. I've been on my job for 26 years. And we have an EAP program, so I called. And I said, you know, my life really sucks, and I think that I need to talk to a counselor. And I called two or three people, and I decided I'd go and see the first person that answered. And it turns out that woman had 10 years sober in AA. So the first time I went to her, and I just said, blah, 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 all these horrible things are happening in my life, and I need to get my act together. She listened, and she said, sounds like you have a drinking problem. And I want you to go to two AA meetings this week. I said, oh, you don't understand, you know, I work at night, I can't, they don't have meetings when I can go, and I'm working 6 days in a row. And she's like, here's a schedule book. So I found, this is funny, the story of my first meeting, I'm getting to the what happened. I found this meeting at noon, and I figured that was a good time for me, because I'd just be waking up. And I went to this clubhouse, and it was actually called Galano, because I thought that Galano was like Italian for wine. I was thinking about Gallo, and somehow in my mind it made sense. So I showed up there at noon, and I'm not gay, by the way, which doesn't matter, but I went to that meeting, and they were talking about recovery from alcoholism, but they were also using some other kind of terms that I wasn't really sure of, you know, back in 93, 94, my partner, and this and that, and I was like, this is a little different. And so then I asked somebody afterwards, is it okay if I keep coming to this meeting, if I came here today? And they're like, yes. And they told me about the 90 and 90, and the only requirement for AA membership is a desire to stop drinking. And that's where I got my white chip. And that was my first introduction to AA. And I found that noon was just a little bit too early for me, so I decided that I would start coming to a later meeting, and I started coming at 1:30 in the afternoon. And my home group became the Think It Through Sober group for many years here at NAVA. And I became active in that group. There's so many people that have helped me along in my sobriety. We really stand on the shoulders of giants in here. You know, there are people who came before us, and I always have a lot of respect for them. And I think about this one guy who was at that meeting, and his name was Jack, and he would be there every day. And he would try to draw me out of my shell. He would try to get me to do one of these readings or give out the chips or something. At first I said, no, I can't. You know, I was too scared to even do the reading. I can't do that. It's too much of a commitment, you know. And but I kept coming, and then he kept asking me to do stuff. And eventually, and it used to really make me angry. I kind of had a resentment. Well, I did have a resentment against him for a while. And I think that's why I kept coming. Like, I'm going to show him. But it gave me a purpose, and I became involved with the home group, and that's very important. So in that group, I became the coffee person for a long time. I don't even drink coffee, but I was in charge of making sure we had coffee, cups, sugar, and I carried it all in the trunk of my car. I'd go to Sam's Club and get the 1,500 box of cups and the 5-pound bag of sugar, and I was ready. And I had it. And one time, I think my car broke down or something, because I was still driving the drunk car when I got into sobriety. And I had not maintained my car. At one point, it actually burned up because I didn't put any oil in it. So anyway, I couldn't make it to the meeting, and I called someone in my neighborhood, and I was freaking out. I'm like, oh my God, I'm in charge of the coffee. I have to be there. And she came and picked me up, and we took a wrong turn, and we got there late, and that's when I realized that the meeting will go on, you know, even if I'm not there. I think it was actually chairing the meeting, not the coffee person. But that day I was supposed to chair the meeting, and I got there, and the meeting had started without me, and I thought, hey, that's great. So having a responsibility, though, was pretty important to me. I became GSR of that group. I think I was also treasurer of that group. One of the funny things that happened was I was asked to chair the meeting, and I did it, I think, on Fridays. And after a few months, about 7 or 8 or 9 months, I said, how long do I have to chair this meeting on Fridays? I've been doing it a long time. And he said, well, you need to find somebody else to replace you. And that's where I learned about the spirit of rotation. So that was really good. You know, I've learned so many things by being part of a home group. And I felt part of. Because as I mentioned, I had low self-esteem when I came in here. I really felt like I had let my family down. I felt like I was pretty worthless. And having those responsibilities really helped. I got myself a sponsor. I asked several women before one finally relented and agreed to be my sponsor. And I realized now they all had very valid reasons. You know, either they had not finished the steps, or they didn't have time, or our schedules didn't match, or whatever. And Cindy was my sponsor for over 20 years. She's moved out of town now. She has some health issues. But she used to call me hard-hearted Hannah. And I didn't like that too much. But she said that I didn't want to let people get close to me. And I think that was just me trying to push people away and not get hurt. And I hope today that I'm not like that anymore. I've found that it's easier for me to let people in. And people loved me until I could love myself. You know, being part of a home group was just so important to my sobriety. I actually met my husband in my home group. And we've been married almost 20 years. We've been together 24 years. I have to put a plug in for him. And AA has helped me in my relationships. And when we hear that, you know, we think about romantic relationships or that. But actually, it's helped me in all my relationships with my family, with my coworkers, neighbors, family, just anything. So I started getting involved with going to step studies and big book studies, and I worked the steps. I did them to the best of my ability at first. I didn't really know what I was doing, but it was important to me to get it out and just start doing them. My life has become awesome. I got married in sobriety. We had a sober wedding. Well, for the most part. Except that one drunk chick. Anyway, my family behaved themselves. Everybody was pretty good. I think the waitresses there at the reception were kind of shocked because they were walking around with that sparkling champagne stuff. Well, the sparkling juice, it wasn't champagne. And everyone was like, oh no, oh no, oh no. Because they thought it was really alcohol. And so they finally, you know, started explaining, this is not alcohol. This is sparkling cider juice, and it's okay. Because most of the people at our wedding were people in sobriety. And that was a real blessing. And also in sobriety, we bought a house together, which is really awesome. Things I never imagined that I would have. I never dreamed of these things. You know, my husband and I, we respect each other. I cherish him. He still makes me smile every time I see him. That's enough of that. Okay. So now, what it's like now. Really, the theme, I guess, of my story is service, service, service. Because when I got 30 days sober, I became involved in service. And I have not stopped. And that's what helped turn the corner in my sobriety. Because I kind of had this idea in the back of my head, subconsciously. If I'm going to stay here, I need to do this deal. Because I don't want to be here and be miserable. and I don't want to not do it and go out. So in my experience, I just got that one white chip. So that's been very, you know, much of a blessing to me too. As far as service work, I love this. There's a saying, there's a little passage in the big book. It's in Bill's story. And the reason I always remember it is because it talks about the certain trials and low spots. And I looked it up, and there's actually a lot more to it before and after that. And I'll just read a couple of lines. For if an alcoholic failed to perfect and enlarge his spiritual life through work and self-sacrifice for others, he could not survive the certain trials and low spots ahead. If he did not work, he would surely drink again. And if he drank, he would surely die. Then faith would be dead indeed. With us, it is just like that. And I heard that, the certain trials and low spots. I heard this so many years ago. And I saw people go through those low spots. I can remember, some people might remember Bill Meadows, and he went through, he and his wife lost babies, and then he lost his wife in a horrific car accident, and then he got brain cancer, and you know what? He showed up. He was always here at the AA meetings, and I saw him one time, and I was shocked. He was sitting back there, and he had just come from, I think, Duke Medical Center, and he had staples in his head from the surgery he'd had. And I was thinking, his doctor would be so pissed if he saw him here at this AA meeting. And then I realized, you know what, that's what he needed to do. And you do it no matter what. I've seen people go through all kinds of things, illness and divorce and suicides and in their family, all kinds of stuff, and stay sober. And that's what reminds me about AA, enabling me to match serenity, to match calamity with serenity. So in other words, when bad things happen, I've got the AA program to back me up. And in July 2008, I was diagnosed with stage 3 colon cancer. And something just told me, and again, another subconscious thing in the back of my head, everything's going to be all right, no matter what. And I didn't know what no matter what meant. I just knew that my higher power was going to take care of me no matter what. And if it meant that that disease was going to take me out, then that's what was going to happen. But during that time, and I had to go through surgery. I had to go through 6 months of chemo. I just had this sense of peace that everything was going to be all right no matter what. And now I have, like, a point of perspective. I could be having the worst day ever, but I just say to myself, you know what, at least I'm not going to chemo today. Because it's awful. It really sucked. And, you know, I got through that, and I recovered. So that's just a testimony that I just trusted God. And everything was okay. And until that point, I kind of had this kind of fuzzy idea of a higher power. I wasn't really sure that I believed. I came in here as an agnostic. But that was one of those kind of burning bush, white light, whatever you want to call it, experiences. So back to the service work. There was a guy named Mike Kerbo. I don't know if any of you know him, but I have to put a shout out to him because he involved me in the Death Sober group. And he started that group in 1995, I think. Judith probably remembers. It was 1995, I think.
Yeah,
95. And I showed up on a Sunday afternoon, and I thought, wow, this is really cool. Because, like I said, I'm always involved, I'm interested in learning languages and culture, and this was a different language, and it's a visual language. And it was so intriguing to me, and I showed up, and I kept coming whenever my schedule allowed me to, and I didn't know sign language at all. I had no deaf people in my family. I really had no experience with You know, being around deaf people or learning sign language or knowing anything about deaf culture, I was really clueless. And I just had a passion for going to that group. And then eventually I decided I wanted to learn sign language. And I went to some classes. And then I went to a 2-year rigorous program, actually an interpreting program. So now I can communicate fairly well, you know, but when it was kind of funny, when I got to my ASL2 class, I actually tested out of ASL1 because I already knew my alphabet and stuff like that and how to say my name. And they had us stand up and do some signs. They're like, okay, like read, eat, sleep, and mine was drink. I was supposed to do the sign for drink. And I did this one, which means drink alcoholically. And that's my teacher's like, what are you doing? And I said, well, that's the only sign for drink I know. I'm sorry. And he said, well, this is the sign for drink. Nicely. Like you're drinking coffee or something. So I had an interesting vocabulary. The few signs that I knew was very interesting. Like I knew, addict and drugs and jail and stuff like that. So they were kind of wondering about me. So, and about Mike Kerbo, he was always involved in doing service work. And I don't think I've ever met anybody else like him. I still think about him quite a lot. I got involved with working the steps, and I've done them a few times. I have a sponsor. I am a sponsor. I've worked the steps. I take women through the steps. That's important stuff to know. I heard this, I think, on a speaker tape the other day, and I just thought it was really cool. As alcoholics, we've been through the wars together, and we have the scars to prove it. I thought that was really cool. Because I think as an alcoholic woman, I can identify with another alcoholic woman like nobody else can. You know, sharing our experience, strength, and hope with each other. So, my life today, I've already touched on most of it, I guess. I've been on my job for 26 years, which has been really amazing. There were times when I just couldn't even get to work, you know, for my shift that started at 5 or 6 in the afternoon because I was too hungover. I became part of that employee assistance program. We had a peer mentoring program, so I became involved with that for a while till they, you know, shipped it off somewhere else. So I've got longevity. Got longevity on my job, I've got longevity in my marriage, and I really never stuck with anything very long before I got sober. So that's kind of amazing to me. And I guess, you know, I've been lucky. I've lived two lives in one lifetime. And I consider myself a survivor for many different reasons. You know, of course, the alcoholism, the domestic violence, the cancer, and the fact that I'm here, you know, I feel very grateful for that. And looking back over my story, you know, I've done this a few times, and it lets me remember what it was like, and it always gives me gratitude to be able to do this. And, you know, I hope people have gotten something out of it today. So really, I just want to tell people that if you stay sober, you know, you've got a shot at life. My life has turned out amazing. If you stay sober, you'll be amazed how it turns out. And I just want to thank everybody for listening and for your attention today.
Thank you so much for your story. I love you. I learn something new about her every time I talk to her. And her husband's right behind her, and I love him too. They're such a cute couple. She has asked Bryant G. to give out the chips.
Hello. How are you all today? I'm so happy to be here. My name is Bryant Garrett and I'm an alcoholic. How are you guys doing?
Great.
So, if today's your first day, you know what to do. So, we have the silver chips here for 30 days. If you've got 30 days, so good. All right. Now we have the red chip here for 90 days. We've got the yellow chip here for 6 months. If anybody has 6 months?
All right!
All right, got this green chip if anybody has 9 months. And 1 year or more, or several years. Then we've got a blue chip here for you.
I'm Steve, an alcoholic for 10 years.
All right.
To my leads, to my friends, thank God for your work.
All right, last week, you know, if anybody was drinking, here's a white chip again to start fresh and new. All right, I just need to ask for the chips you have.
Thank you one and all for joining the Blue Chip Speakers meeting tonight.
Give me some time to receive the message of being free. Give me some time to breathe. It's not that I don't want to see. Understood your words to go ahead and forget my world. Oh, and I surrender, that even darkness could be a light. Oh, myself not to cry. I feel like a long lost child.